From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. There's a new TV spot out today that takes on the idea of clean coal, a subject that came up in the presidential debates. The election is over, but this policy debate goes on. Our co-host Robert Siegel has been hearing the arguments for and against.
The new commercial is against clean coal.
So let's take a tour of the state-of-the-art clean coal facility. Amazing! Machinery's kind of loud, but that's the sound of clean coal technology.
That actor is actually walking through a doorway to nowhere in the middle of a desert. He's pointing to a wilderness. The idea is clean coal is the emperor's new clothes. The reality is it just doesn't exist. The commercial is paid for by the Alliance for Climate Protection, the group chaired by former Vice President Al Gore, who joins us from California. Welcome to the program.
Oh, well, thank you.
The American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity, the group that advertises in favor of clean coal, says they've made a commitment to use coal cleanly, wisely, and they've shown great progress in achieving that goal. What's wrong with that statement?
Well, the question is not whether you're for it or against it. The question is whether or not it exists. It is a theoretical possibility, and if it could be brought into existence at some future date, at some unspecified cost, then it would be great. But it doesn't exist now. It's not anywhere close to being a reality. And we cannot continue to have the construction of all these incredibly dirty and dangerous polluting coal plants, which are the principal cause of global warming, proceed on the assumption that this technology is going to soon be available. Mm-hmm. If it can be created, if it can be paid for, if it works, then wonderful. But let's don't pretend that it exists now. It does not.
The consulting firm McKinsey & Company studied CO2 capture and storage technologies in Europe, technologies by which you capture nearly all the carbon dioxide that's emitted by a coal-burning plant and you store it. And they concluded that by the year 2030, this all could check out, at least in Europe. Does 2030 sound like a date that's worth working toward and starting to build a pilot project for?
Oh, I'm all for research and development and pilot projects. As of now, however, there is not a single large-scale demonstration project anywhere in the United States of America that is using this carbon capture and sequestration. Theoretically, it can play a significant role, but it's not realistic or sane to build all these incredibly dangerous facilities on the assumption that they can soon be retrofitted with a technology that doesn't yet exist.
If indeed it's a couple of decades away, is that worth a big investment by the federal government in technologies to make it become feasible, or should that be the business of the power industry?
No, I think it's responsible for the federal government to contribute funds to research and development for the exploration of whether or not this carbon capture and sequestration technology, as they call it, could make coal a responsible and safe energy option.
What's the incentive to pretend that it's going to be available shortly, for the industry to pretend?
The industry has spent $250 million this year alone in promoting this oxymoron, the phrase clean coal, as if it presently exists. But their incentive to pretend that it may soon be a reality is in order to stave off the regulation of CO2 and the imposition of measures that will sharply reduce the global warming pollution that is the cause of the climate crisis.
Well, former Vice President Al Gore, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
The clean coal commercials that inspired Al Gore's group come from an industry group called the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity, or ACE. Here's part of one of their ads that we recorded off of YouTube.
With new technologies, we can reduce greenhouse gas emissions and keep energy costs affordable.
We will do this.
And on the screen at the end of that spot, it says clean coal. Joe Lucas is Vice President for Communications for the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
To the program. What do you think of the ad campaign that's now launched against you, saying, in reality, there's no such thing as clean coal?
Well, I don't agree with that at all. Clean coal is a term of art that's been around for over 30 years, and it's shorthand for clean coal technology. It is that whole suite of technologies that have been used to reduce the environmental footprint of using coal to generate electricity. We've made tremendous progress in reducing the environmental footprint of using coal to generate electricity.
When McKinsey and Company, the big consultant firm, studied CO2 capture and storage technologies in Europe, they defined the aim of all of this as capturing around 90% of carbon dioxide emissions from a coal-burning plant. If that is what clean coal is, does it exist right now? Is there really an existing big industrial-scale plant in which you can capture 90% of the CO2?
There is not that plant, but that is not what clean coal is today. Clean coal is an evolutionary term, just like medical technology. 30 years ago, when we didn't have MRI machines, we didn't say that we didn't have medical technology, but now we have medical technology that includes MRI machines, so our understanding of what is medical technology has evolved.
Don't you think that the analogy between clean coal and medical technology is a bit imperfect here, that clean coal is a value judgment? It implies something good, successful, that has happened. Medical technology implies no particular success. It's just a great enterprise. Clean coal seems to imply it's good. It's here.
I don't agree with you that it is a misnomer or a misuse of the term at all. It is, in fact, talking about this evolutionary progress that we have made over the years. And if you had the vice president and me sitting side by side here in the studio, we would agree that the ultimate goal is to reach that zero emissions portfolio. The answer is, how do we get there? How fast? And how much does it cost?
But there is a difference between a process and a product. The process, you're saying, is the process of, over the years, making clean coal. Right now, the product, clean coal, meaning coal that emits hardly any carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, that's not here yet.
Well, somebody asked me that question over a year ago about clean coal, and I said I learned a long time ago when my mother told me to go clean my room that people's value judgment of what was clean was different. I thought I did a very good job on cleaning my room, only to find out that her definition was different. And the fact
is, what about that McKinsey definition? They said 90% of the CO2 emitted from the burning of the coal would be captured, and then you could store it somewhere.
That's what they described. When I look at what the majority of Americans say is clean coal, is the fact that we're using technology today to reduce the emissions of hazardous air pollutants, and the fact that we will be able to, over the next 10 years, begin to bring technologies into the marketplace to capture and store carbon. That's what the American people believe that clean coal is.
But, Mr. Lucas, you're also saying that you've influenced that opinion. I mean, that in part what people are saying clean coal is in part what you've gotten them to think it is from campaigning for the past 8 years.
Well, but I think that the American public looks at things. I mean, what you see over time is that today, the reality is Americans believe, and in great measure, the coal-based electricity sector has been able to deliver affordable, reliable energy using domestic energy resources where applicable, keep costs low, and continuous environmental improvement. That's what we've done up until this point, and that's what we'll do going forward.
That's Joe Lucas, who is Vice President for Communications with the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. Earlier, we heard from former Vice President Al Gore, who now chairs the Alliance for Climate Protection.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. In its last days in power, the Bush administration is finishing up work on a whole array of regulations. One of the most controversial changes relates to the mining method of mountaintop removal. Yesterday, the Environmental Protection Agency signed off on a new rule which makes it easier for mining companies to dump their waste into nearby rivers and streams. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren has been covering this issue. And Elizabeth, why don't you explain about mountaintop mining and what this debris is that we're talking about?
I've actually seen this in West Virginia. I've flown over it by air and been on one mountaintop looking over to another mountaintop where this was going on. The coal companies take huge machines they call drag lines, and they literally take the top of the mountains off. Envision, say, a layer cake, a multi-layered cake, and the coal lies in, like the frosting, in between the layers. So the companies will take the rock and dirt off and take away the coal, and they put this rock and dirt that's left over into the valleys, these high mountain valleys. valleys and streams. And so far, they've literally covered up 1,200 miles of streams with this process. So it's a big process that's going on all over Appalachia, in West Virginia, in Kentucky, in Tennessee. And as they go about it, there's a lot of environmental impacts. Of course, they have to cut down the forests in order to do this. That chases away songbirds. This also increases flooding. And so there's flooding in the valleys where the people live below. And then, of course, to blow up the mountains, they need a lot of explosives, and there are some impacts of those as well.
This rule has been in place for about 25 years, limiting where this debris could go, how close it could be to streams. But why did the Bush administration feel it wanted to change this rule?
Well, there had been a lot of uncertainty about how the rule was being applied. It's called the buffer zone rule, and it says that you can't do any mining within 100 feet of a stream, which seems pretty clear, but it gives some caveats. And those caveats is part of what this argument is all about. One federal judge several years ago decided that this rule basically made the whole process of mountaintop mining illegal. That ruling got overturned on a procedural matter. And so since then, there's been a question of what would happen. And even though this rule has been on the books, both the Clinton administration and the Bush administration have given these mines permits to do exactly what they do.
Now, the mining industry is very happy about this rule change. Environmentalists obviously are not. I saw this quote from a leading environmentalist in Kentucky. He called it an early Christmas present to the industry. How are the officials at EPA explaining why they signed on to this rule change, allowing dumping close to streams or in streams?
Well, they say that nothing about this violates the Clean Water Act. And they say that one of the things that made them sign off on it was that, in fact, one of the things they did is they fought to keep on this rule a specification that the mines cannot violate water quality standards, either federal or state water quality standards. And they say that this does not violate the Clean Water Act.
How is that possible? If you're closing off or blocking off a stream, how does that not violate the Clean Water Act?
Well, that's very hard to understand. And that's, in fact, what this Judge Hayden had decided when he ruled against this procedure. He said you can't basically cover up miles and miles of stream and say it doesn't affect water quality. There is no more water. So how is it? I mean, there might be water seeping out somewhere, but it clearly affects water quality and it affects streams. And that's But it's a very difficult situation here, because what you've got is two priorities that are fighting against each other. You've got the desire to produce cheap electricity, and everybody wants to pay a low price bill. And fighting against that, you've got the desire to preserve landscapes, and that's a big deal, too.
With the new Obama administration coming in, let's say they wanted to overturn this rule. Could they do that? How would they do that if they wanted to?
Well, first off, it's not exactly clear what an Obama administration would want to do about mountaintop mining. During the campaign, Mr. Obama did say he had concerns about what mountaintop mining was doing to Appalachia. Unlike his opponent, Senator McCain, he didn't say that he wanted to stop it outright. And the politics of mountaintop mining are very complicated. Congress also has the power to reject this rule if it wants to. But senior senators from West Virginia actually support mountaintop mining. And so it's not clear exactly what would happen, especially because more and more politicians from the region are standing up to say they have concerns about mountaintop mining. The governors of both Tennessee and Kentucky wrote the EPA to ask them not to sign off on this rule.
Okay, NPR's Elizabeth Shogren, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Now to the future for cars. If you're thinking about buying an electric car with a rechargeable battery someday, where might you plug that in? A startup company in Silicon Valley wants to install charging machines throughout the country. And at least one city in the San Francisco Bay Area plans to set up car charge outlets on lampposts and parking lots, maybe even on parking meters. From member station KQED, David Gorin reports.
It's pretty easy to find the car of Richard Lowenthal. You just follow the extension cord.
We'll plug my car into a charging station.
All through the lobby of Coulomb Technologies, a yellow plastic cord snakes its way out the front door, down the walk, across the parking lot.
You see how I have to charge now? This is like the extension cord draped across our parking lot. Everybody driving on it.
Lowenthal has to run 75 feet of power cord across the lot because he owns a plug-in hybrid. It's a car that runs solely on electricity when it's charged up and can use gas if it runs out of batteries. Electricity has the promise, Lowenthal says, to be the perfect fuel for cars.
But if I want to use it, I have to be able to get it. And right now, to get it when I'm at work, I have to get it through extension cords.
That's one reason why Lowenthal started up his small company in Campbell, California. People at work will need car charging stations, he says. So he wants to install them throughout the Bay Area and eventually the nation. And he could really use one of them right now. But here's the catch. You need a power source, and that doesn't currently exist in Lowenthal's parking lot. The city, though, could have car chargers just about anywhere there's electricity, at parking meters, in parking lots, at the base of streetlights. And that's what the city of San Jose has in mind. Its director of transportation, Jim Helmer, says they're buying and installing a dozen of the chargers.
San Jose, Silicon Valley is, a highly technical region, and it's often referred to as creative destruction, where we constantly are looking for new ideas that take the place of past good ideas.
Right now, Helmer admits, there aren't a whole lot of electric vehicles tooling around the city. The plan is to set the chargers up, so when the electric car revolution does come, San Jose will be ready.
Electric vehicles have a very promising future.
Daniel Sperling is head of the Institute for Transportation Studies at UC Davis.
Clearly, if we're going to get off oil and we're going to reduce greenhouse gases, electric drive and electric batteries are absolutely key to that. The sooner we get on with it, the better.
From CEO Lowenthal's point of view, it's still too early to make a profit on his car chargers, but that doesn't mean he shouldn't make them. Lowenthal sees his company as one of the tipping points that might nudge people toward buying an electric car once those cars do hit the mainstream market in a few years. See, if you don't have car chargers around, he says, maybe people would worry about running out of juice and wouldn't choose to buy electric cars. It's a dilemma, Lowenthal says. You can't make money on the chargers until the cars are sold. You can't sell the cars without charging choices.
We have a little chicken and egg problem here. And we've decided to buck the trend on chickens and eggs here. We're going to do chickens and eggs simultaneously.
And when electric cars do charge into America, Lowenthal will be set. And his fledgling business, he hopes, will hatch into something big. For NPR News, I'm David Korn.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. There are outdoorsmen, and then there are people like Stephen Ranella. He's an extreme outdoorsman. Plus, he writes about it. The last time we heard from him, he'd written a book called The Scavenger's Guide to Haute Cuisine. It details a 3-day, 45-course meal consisting of some wild animals you wouldn't want to see alive, much less on your plate. Animals Mr. Ranella caught himself. In his latest book, he describes hunting a more familiar animal.
I centered the crosshairs on the animal about 3 or 4 ribs back behind the front shoulder, halfway up and down the body, and I pulled the trigger. And it fell immediately and slid down a snowy hillside and crashed into a stand of timber. And by the time I got down there, it was dead.
It was a buffalo. Ranella won a lottery to hunt buffalo in Alaska. His new book is called American Buffalo, and it tells that story, woven together with tales of the buffalo's place in American history. Ranella told me his obsession with the animal began long ago.
There's stages to this, because when I was a little kid, I always fancied that I would be, I grew up in Michigan, which is one of the few states that has no buffalo in it historically, but I always fancied that I would be a mountain man. And then in 1999, after I finally did move to Montana, I was up in the mountains at about right around 9,000 feet above sea level in the Madison Mountains. And my brother kicked at a little something on the ground. I looked and he had kicked at a piece of bone and walked on. And I started digging around that bone and unearthed a skull. It was from a bull. I later had it radiocarbon dated. It was from sometime within a couple decades of 1750 that it died. When I found this thing, I didn't know what it meant, but I knew it meant a lot to me. And that out of that emerged sort of an insatiable interest in the animal.
Now, for many people, that might spark an interest to learn more about buffalo, to perhaps spend more time with them. In this case, you wound up entering a lottery that would allow you to travel to Alaska and hunt and kill this animal.
Yeah. Well, I found the skull, like I said, in 1999. And out of that, I spent a lot of time reading about and talking to people who knew about the great long history of human habitation in North America that goes back about, 14 or 15,000 years. The first people that came to North America, we know so little about them. We don't know what their concept of the landscape was. We don't know what they did with their dead. We don't know what their notions of God were. But we know that they ate a lot of buffalo meat. And I just kind of began to feel like this was something I really wanted to do and something I wanted to experience. And so I put in for the lottery in Alaska. And that year they were giving out 24 permits, and 1,303, I think, applied. It was about a 2% chance of drawing. And I drew the permit. I was lucky. I drew the permit. It was like luck journalism, I guess.
You chronicle your hunt throughout the book, but you also convey a lot of information about the history of buffalo in America. And there's one thing you note repeatedly in the book, that at one point there were millions of buffalo roaming throughout the Great Plains, actually roaming throughout the country. And then at around 1911, there were only about 2,200 buffalo left. What in the heck happened to all those buffalo?
Right at the time of European contact with the introduction of the horse, you start to see the numbers were shrinking and they were losing habitat just because the Native Americans are more effective at hunting. And then as white settlers came in and hunted for meat, the numbers went down a little bit. But finally, the great cataclysmic event that really led to the near extermination of them was there was some advancements in tanning and in the production of leather that were made, industrial tanning, to tan buffalo hides so that they were elastic. They were suitable for industrial belting. They were good for footwear. So tanneries in Europe and tanneries in the eastern United States began ordering as many as they could get. And from that point forward, millions of buffalo hides per year were being shipped out. And so you have really, between about 1872 and 1881, the final 15 million were eliminated. It got to a point where a lightning strike could have eliminated, you know, half the buffalo living in North America.
Given the animal's history and your obvious respect for buffalo, did you have any reservations about participating in that Alaska hunt?
You know, I did in a way because I knew that when I went into this, I knew that it would wind up being a little bit difficult for me to kill a buffalo. And I say that only because of the things that have been, the atrocities that have been exacted upon the animal. And it's a great, it's a huge irony, and it's something that takes a lot of explanation. But most of my interest in the buffalo as an animal comes out of my interest with human-buffalo interactions. And I felt like I wanted to jump in and participate in that. But rather than participating in it in the way that, like, a famous buffalo hunter killed 20,000 for the hides, that I would do this one time, and I would do it in a way that didn't guarantee my success. And I wanted it to be a challenge, and I wanted it to be a wilderness experience, and I wanted it to be something that was limited in scope. I will not do it again. I will not kill another buffalo.
You said you'd never do this again, but you had done quite a bit of prep work just to gather the equipment you would need for something like this. But I'm wondering how you had to psychologically prepare for that point where you had a buffalo in your sights.
You know, I grappled more with, like, finding one and getting close with one, and I never had any doubt about what I would do. And only after I did it did it really strike me what I had done. And my feeling about it changed once I had built up this, like, I had 3 days of sustenance from this animal. And I had not been getting much to eat, and all of a sudden I was eating more of it. And I kind of got this feeling of the animal as a great provider. And I didn't really finally feel totally great about what had happened until that June. I flew back up into that area. I hired a bush pilot to take me up into the area where these animals calve, and I went up there and camped for a few days and watched them during the spring calving season and watched the young ones. And then I had more of a sense of the renewal, and there are more now in that area than there were the year I hunted.
At the end of this, you come to an interesting conclusion, which you describe in the last chapter, and I'm wondering if you would mind reading from that. I think it's in the hardcover on page 255.
I sometimes imagine that we saved the buffalo from the brink of extinction for the simple reason that the animal provided a handy mirror in which we could see our innermost desires and failures and our most confounding contradictions. Our efforts to use the buffalo as a looking glass have rendered the animal almost inscrutable. At once, it is a symbol of the tenacity of wilderness and the destruction of wilderness. It's a symbol of Native American culture and the death of Native American culture. It's a symbol of the strength and vitality of America and the pettiness and greed of America. It represents a frontier both forgotten and remembered. It stands for freedom and captivity, extinction and salvation.
Stephen Minella, it's been good to talk to you again. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Stephen Minella is the author of the memoir American Buffalo, In Search of a Lost Icon.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The U.S. Supreme Court hears an important environmental case today. It involves pollution from power plants. The question is whether plants must use the best technology available to protect nearby waterways. The Bush administration granted an exception to that rule. They did not have to use the best technology if it was considered too expensive. And that led to a court battle that the justices are now being asked to decide. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports on why the case matters.
The nation's 550 power plants use water, lots of water in some instances, and the water comes from the nation's lakes and rivers. Each day, more than 214 billion gallons of water, that's billion with a B, is sucked into power plants across the country. That's more than 100 trillion gallons each year. The water cools the steam that's used in generating electricity, and the fish and aquatic organisms are killed in the process. In contrast, in modern plants, little or no water is needed at all. Air instead of water is used for cooling, or in some instances, a different water system that uses a small amount of water and recycles it. The question in this case involves older plants and whether they have to install new technology to minimize the harm to the nation's lakes and rivers. The companies say installing the best technology is too expensive, and the Bush administration adopted a rule that would allow utilities to get a variance from the Environmental Protection Agency if they can show that the cost of complying is greater than the environmental benefits. Environmentalists contend that Congress specifically rejected the cost-benefit approach because Congress itself concluded that the costs were worth the benefits to the environment. Moreover, environmentalists contend that a case-by-case cost-benefit analysis is too subject to manipulation. Georgetown Law Professor Lisa Heinzerling explains why.
Clean Water Act doesn't fare very well if it becomes a cost-benefit statute. Lots of fish aren't really worth that much when it comes down to trying to put a dollar value on them.
Six states and environmental groups challenged the Bush administration approach, contending that the language of the statute requiring the best technology available is clear and unequivocal. They won in the lower courts, and the utilities appealed to the Supreme Court, which will hear arguments today. The states point out that the utility plants sit on state lakes and rivers and use their water for free. Rhode Island Assistant Attorney General Tricia Yeadley notes, for example, that the Brayton utility plant in her state takes a billion gallons of water a day, killing every living thing in the water.
Our finfish and winter flounder populations have collapsed. And we've lost a viable commercial and recreational fishing resource that have been used by Rhode Islanders for millennia.
Environmental lawyer Reed Super adds that utility plants are enormously profitable.
That company never said they couldn't afford it. They just said they didn't want to do it.
But the utilities counter that Congress never intended to impose new technology costs on the industry without weighing costs against benefits. Carter Phillips represents a number of utilities.
If you don't have at least some cost-benefit analysis that's incorporated into this approach, you know, the possibility of having to spend literally hundreds of millions of dollars to save a handful of fish strikes me as palpably absurd, and that's the problem. Is if you say no cost benefit analysis is appropriate, then you end up with this wildly out of sync regulatory scheme.
Phillips contends that weighing costs and benefits is something that federal and state agencies do every day, and he observes that a Democratic Obama administration may weigh costs and benefits quite differently than the Bush administration did.
Who's running EPA may make a big difference in terms of what the cost-benefit analysis is going to look like.
So, does it matter what the court says? You bet it does. For more than a quarter century, industry has tried to put a cost-benefit overlay on environmental regulations. But in the past, it has often come a cropper in the courts. Now, with the Supreme Court's new conservative composition, industry thinks it has a good shot at winning. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The economic slump appears to have affected Europe's effort to improve the environment. European car makers seem to have won a tentative victory in their efforts to stave off a deadline for tougher emission standards. Terry Schultz has more from Brussels.
Even before the dramatic downturn in the global economy, the auto industry claimed it would be severely damaged by stringent new caps on greenhouse gas emissions proposed by the European Commission, the EU's executive arm, to go into effect in 2012. Now carmakers say it could be a crippling blow if they're forced to invest heavily in developing new models and carbon-cutting technology, with consumer demand falling. The government of Germany, as Europe's largest auto producer of Europe's largest autos, took up its manufacturer's fight against the new limits, backed by data showing 6 months of falling car sales, a plunge of almost 15% in October alone. And in closed-door talks late yesterday, negotiators from EU governments and the European Parliament agreed the standards would only apply to all new cars in 6 years rather than the Commission's 3-year deadline. They also reduced the fines for failure to comply. Olivier Hodeman of the European watchdog group Corporate Europe Observatory calls the deal a huge disappointment, a success for what he calls scaremongering by the auto industry.
It's an example of how vested interests manage to postpone and sometimes even prevent very necessary environmental regulations.
The provisional agreement still needs to pass the full European Parliament and all 27 EU governments, but negotiators say they expect swift approval. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.